Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Daily Premier League news and views. This is Football Social Daily.
This is Football Social Daily, a daily Premier League podcast from Sports Social. Happy Monday. I'm Jim Sowerson and we are back into a bumper week of footballing action with Premier League, with Europa League, with Champions League football, all lined up over the next few days and ready to go. But what a weekend it has been at both ends of the table. You can catch up with Fergal, with Sam Lee and with Johnny Smith, all talking about the fight at the top and the bottom of the Premier League. That is on yesterday's podcast. Just go back in the Football Social Daily timeline to find all that chat. But today, we are looking ahead. We're looking ahead to Crystal Palace versus Leeds, as the Yorkshire club are still looking to pick up those vital points that could help them avoid the drop. We're also going to be looking ahead to some new laws and regulations that could help protect the future of football clubs like Bury and like Oldham as the government seeks to introduce an independent body of football governance as a result of a fan consultation. We'll give you the details and dig into what it could mean shortly on Football Social Daily. To provide the expertise on those topics, we've got Marley Anderson. How you doing, Marley?
Good morning. Yes, better than I was the last time I was on a podcast with with you guys. So yeah,
which was Friday after the Christmas party around these parts. Niall was at that as well, and I've come into the office this morning, Niall, because we're all in the office today. We're not always in the office every day of the week, and you've been dubbed Mr. Saturday Night Fever after your exploits at the Christmas party. Do you want to expand on that in any way?
I would if I could remember, but I can't, which is probably a good thing by the sounds of it. No, I don't get out very much on nights out these days, so I like to let my proverbial hair down and have a bit of a boogie, but I had really good time, so I'm not going to sit here and feel embarrassed because I've thoroughly enjoyed it.
I'm gutted I missed it just because of the moves now. But
I'd love to say, you know, Niall was Mr. Saturday Night Fever, but I also don't remember. Like, I don't know. I don't know if Niall had the dance or not. I couldn't tell you whether Niall had a scrap with 18 bouncers at once or had a fight, like, or had a dance or whatever. Just do not remember anything. So
give it a couple of weeks. I'm sure there's some videos floating around somewhere that will come out. We'll have to do them. If they do come out, you will be able to find them on the Sports Social media channels at the Sports Social on Twitter. We'll have a conversation about that one. Anyway, let's kick off Monday. Let's forget all this frivolity and happiness. Yeah, let's kick it off with a good old whinge, because on Monday we start with a Monday moan. Get in the sea is an opportunity to vent spleen about one thing that has happened over the footballing weekend that you've just had enough of. You just want it to get in the sea. Marley, you said you've got a load today, so I'm going to force you to whittle it down to one. What are you picking?
I'm going to pick my original one that I had. It actually comes from slightly before the weekend, but it's still relative to football and to what's going on this weekend. And it is the furore and the little circus that is now following Erik ten Hag around Amsterdam. When he's literally just trying to do his job. Like, I don't think for a minute that Man United wanted to announce Ten Hag until the summer, until at least the final whistle on the final day. Don't believe that at all. So, but because they were so bad against Liverpool and because they were in such a bad time, they had to do something. So they had to announce it. And as soon as they've announced it, Sky Sports have went, right, we need a reporter to go to Amsterdam and pester him, basically. Just hound him. Go out, stand outside the training ground for 8 hours a day, try and get a little sound bite, which doesn't tell anyone anything, like this whole thing. So my issue is the reporter they sent out there is called Gary Cottrell, and at the best of times he's cringe. He's your sort of old man journalist, like, trying to be funny, and it's so bad and so cringe. But it wound me up, and it was Friday. I watched a little clip from Sky Sports, and it was him waiting outside the training ground, and Erik ten Hag pulls up in his nice little 4x4 type thing, and he pauses for a picture with a dad, and his dad's got this his son on his arm, and his son must be about 3 or 4, and like obviously the Ajax fans have been waiting outside the training ground all day, and the picture's being taken and Ten Hag's posing and stuff like that, and this Gary Cottrell just crashes in with his microphone and just goes, "Oh, Eric, you must be looking forward to the Man United job." And Ten Hag just puts his hand up and goes, "Nah, see you later. I'm driving off."
He's not enjoying the Man United.
He just couldn't blame him. Drove off, didn't he?
Just, yeah. And I was like, if I was that dad who'd been there with his kid and you know trying to make his kid's day, and this ball bag had got in my way, I'd have just decked him. I'd have just absolutely wiped him out, because it doesn't, like, the thing which winds me up as well, like, even if he gets his interview, which he's been pushing with, he was in his press conference after the Ajax game at the weekend, and he asked him again, you know, stuff like, oh, you know, have you decided what you're going to do at Man United yet, and what your order of business is, and what the problems are, and how do you assess how they are now? He's not going to give you an answer. He's not going to give you a good answer. He's not going to say, yeah, I've decided we're going to play 4-3-3 next season. You know, Maguire's going to get another chance because I think there's a player there. But Phil Jones has been on too much for two. He's not going to say all this. He's not going to give you the tactics. He's not going to give you any insight. And he's not going to disrespect Ajax, who've built him to what he is now. And he's not going to just stab him like that. So what's the point? Like, you're just wasting money sending this divvy over there to ask questions which no one really cares about, because everyone with half a brain knows that he's not going to give an answer until he starts the Man United job officially.
It must be the kind of thing that puts people off being Manchester United manager, and it's in no way it's unique
it's
to Manchester
happened
United.
Happened with Van Gaal
as
well.
Club, isn't
well,
it?
Do you know what the interesting thing is in the sort of debrief of that incident that Marley was saying, they had the reporter on screen and he was explaining what happened. They showed the clip.
Yeah.
And he went, oh, well, he's going to have to get used to this a bit more. It doesn't seem like he's comfortable with being Manchester United manager. It's like, he's been Manchester United manager for about 35 minutes, mate.
I could have thrown my laptop when he's tried to stick up for himself. Like, I didn't do anything wrong.
It was more he's going to need to get used to the level of media scrutiny and he doesn't look comfortable. It's like, well, the guy's literally just finished training. He's had a photo with a fan and his old man, and it's like, of course he doesn't want to talk to you. And it was one of those things where another question in the press conference that Marley says was, another poor result for Manchester United today. They lost to Arsenal. Is it turning out to be a harder job than you expected? He's like, he's had the job one day. And in fact, he's not even got the job yet. The contract doesn't start until June. So he's not even in the job. He's working for Ajax. So I can understand why Marley's annoyed at that.
It is slightly interesting they've decided to. I mean, I know we've covered the appointment of Ten Hag or the announcement of Ten Hag previously, but it is interesting that they've decided to do it at this point in the season when we've seen a similar situation with Manuel Pellegrini in his job at Man City when Pep Guardiola came in that it's kind of, it turns your current boss into a bit of a dead duck. I don't know what kind of atmosphere change it has within the dressing room, because clearly the players would have known he was coming in anyway.
Yeah.
But it just creates a kind of weird narrative around the football club.
I guess what I know what you're saying, but with the Pellegrini situation, you know, I don't think Rangnick is in that sort of position. I think everyone knew that Rangnick was going to move on, whether that be completely out of the club or up to the consultancy role that we're expecting him to move into. So I think that there's a difference there, but I do know what you mean, and I think actually Rangnick is okay with that. I think he probably knows that his coaching days are behind him a little bit, and it was quite a surprise that he even came into United as interim to coach, because he's been a sporting director or above board and, you know, in those sorts of important meetings looking at the outlook and the vision of a club for his last 5 or 6 years. So I can't even remember the last club he actually managed. I think maybe it was Leipzig 5 or 6 years ago. So I think with Rangnick, everyone knew that was going to be the case. So I don't think it has as big an effect as people might think on Rangnick's authority, because I think Rangnick will still be there, probably in a even more powerful position next season with the consultancy role. So we'll wait and see. But I do understand that... you know, we're going to hear a lot from Erik ten Hag and a lot about Erik ten Hag. And, you know, if, let's just say, Manchester United start next season the way Arsenal started this season, losing the first three games, I just wonder what the reaction will be.
Yeah, be interesting to see how his tenure as Manchester United boss, when it actually does start, how it does start. Right, Niall, what have you got for getting in the sea this week?
Right, so I watched a couple of games this weekend. I watched Arsenal versus Manchester United on Saturday, and then yesterday I thought I'd take in the Merseyside derby, Everton versus Liverpool. And to be honest, I thought I was just going to watch Liverpool trounce Everton and walk all over them. And I really like Liverpool. I respect them as a football club. I know a few Liverpool fans. All of the ones that I do know are sound. The one thing that winds me up is I feel like there's far too much of a love-in with the Liverpool Football Club in general. Yes, they're a club who are historically fantastic. They've won major trophies. They're one of, some would say, the biggest club in the country. And I get that. And there are also kind of cultural things that go hand in hand with Liverpool. So everyone kind of waxes lyrical about the Anfield atmosphere on a European night, you know. But the one thing that really got to me, I looked at my watch. It was 4:31 p.m. The game was meant to kick off at 4:30. And they waited for You'll Never Walk Alone to finish before kicking the game off. Okay, I get it. It's a famous song, whatever. But Everton are playing in this match as well. If the match is meant to kick off at 5:30...
Is your moan the punctuality of the stadium announcer?
No, it's not the stadium announcer. It's the only club in the country where you have to wait for a bloody song to finish start the game.
It's not the national anthem.
You know, they don't wait for Play Up Pompey to finish before they kick off games at Fratton Park. The referee just says, right, it's 4:30. Come on, lads, we're going. And it's the only club where it happens. It happened at the FA Cup semi-final as well, where they played You'll Never Walk Alone as the teams were walking out.
But does it make a difference, really?
I don't know if it makes a difference, but I just think it just seems a bit odd, don't you think?
I think the whole loving around Liverpool is a little bit odd.
It's more the all of the little frilly bits that go around with it, like Jurgen Klopp's fist pumps to the crowd and like as if a manager's never shown passion before in his life. And the playing of You'll Never Walk Alone is traditional at Anfield, but play it 5 minutes before the teams or when the teams are walking out. Don't play it when the game's about to kick off. And then the referee just or the producers at Sky waiting for that song to finish before they kick the game off. Just start. I mean, the match is between two teams. Not one team.
This was summed up, actually, by something I saw on the Premier League official Twitter account over the weekend. I don't know if you saw this.
It was just after
the Derby victory.
Yep.
And there was a pointing up finger pointing to the Premier League word in their Twitter title.
Yep.
And then it just said, step closer, #LiveEverton. And it's like, it doesn't feel like language that would be used for any other club other than Liverpool. That is the kind of thing you'd expect to see from a Liverpool fan account rather than the Premier League account.
I think the whole thing, Jim, probably ties into your getting the C as well, because, you know, we talk about there being some sort of unconscious bias. I mean, that naturally there would have been more people supporting Liverpool yesterday than there weren't, I think, because they're a bigger club with more supporters. Yeah. So I think that makes sense. But, you know, there was even the runoff into the Sky coverage, which I'm sure you'll come on to with your getting the C.
Yes.
But Jamie Carragher had a few critics on social media as well for the nature of the way he called the match on commentary.
That's a good junction at which to roll into my getting the C, which might be one that brings people down either side of the fence, because my Monday moan is about people moaning about Jamie Carragher being on commentary duty for Liverpool Everton because he was too biased, because he didn't give a fair calling of the game, as you say. Now, this kind of focused largely over the incident where Richarlison became the first player in history to be injured by someone else's step over, and he did his ankle and rolled over on the floor, and which Jamie Carragher started shouting, "Get up, get up!" because he believed Richarlison was faking, when in fact he probably had hurt his ankle, although he did go on to play the rest of the game. And I guess part of that is Richarlison's history for historics. It's like, it just kind of like, that's part of his game, so it's understandable that when he's gone down, someone might think that he's play-acting a little bit. But the vitriol that Jamie Carragher got for supporting Liverpool during that game and being very one-sided in his commentary, I thought was a little bit ridiculous. And I kind of think the expectations for football commentators to be unbiased is unrealistic and also would be so dull. Who wants to watch Match of the Day every day? Because that's exactly what happens on Match of the Day, and it is boring ass.
Yeah, here in the UK it's a bit different, because obviously the BBC, we have understood over decades that they have this duty to be impartial as the national broadcaster. So I think Match of the Day, when you watch that BBC broadcast, is probably slightly more neutral. Whereas Sky Sports have no obligation to be neutral. No. They never claim to be neutral. Martin Tyler is the main commentator on the game, and you'd expect him to be neutral, seeing he's a Woking supporter.
Assistant manager as well at Woking.
Is he really? Yeah, so he's not even in the football league as a fan. you know, he's a non-league fan of a team near London. So Jamie Carragher, however, isn't. Grew up as an Everton fan, played for Liverpool, won the Champions League there. So, you know, you can't expect him to be neutral in a game of this
it's
magnitude.
Entertainment it's entertainment as well.
It's just not going
to
happen.
It's entertainment. It's like you're supposed to watch it and you're supposed to feel emotion. You're supposed to be angry. You're supposed to react to it. But some of the tweets I saw, this is one of my favourites. Chris Hockeying, 22, on Twitter, said, "When did Sky bring back fan commentary? Carragher is disgraceful. Supposed to be impartial. And yet he clearly had Anna Glenda against Richarlison." I don't know who Anna Glenda is. I assume it's a tennis player of some kind. But yeah, I mean, you look on Twitter and there's thousands and thousands of tweets and posts having a go at Carragher for being impartial.
So you're
all
right with it being biased?
Yeah, 100%.
Because you're neutral?
But no, I don't.
Because if you were an Everton fan, there was a Liverpool legend on commentary, I don't think you'd be as happy.
I don't think you'd be as unbothered. I don't think I'd be bothered.
But you can understand why people are bothered, because it winds me up when they put it's a bit different broadcaster, but it's BT when BT put Steve McManaman on Liverpool commentary, and then
I mean I can understand getting upset by Steve McManaman being on commentary. To be honest with you,
I mean I then just... they go to a Man United match and the pundits are, you know, Scholes, Ferdinand, and Fletcher, and they're all just stood there with like glum faces.
But I think
I don't know. I do quite like that one.
I think you've got to have thicker skin than that as a football fan. You've got to understand as well that a broadcaster like Sky TV, they play to their audience, and as Niall points out, the majority of that audience for Liverpool Everton would have been Liverpool fans. The majority of Manchester United versus Newcastle viewers would have been Manchester United fans, and you've got to appeal to that audience to a certain extent.
Yeah.
And as a football fan, get over it. Don't worry about it. It's just a bloke talking about football.
Yeah, I get that, but they wouldn't put, say it was Liverpool against West Ham, they wouldn't put our old mate Matty Jarvis on commentary from a West Ham perspective, would they?
No.
And that's kind of part of the argument, I guess. I can see why Everton fans be annoyed about it, 100%. 100%, because...
But didn't they have Kevin Campbell in the studio as well?
They did, yeah. But
and
I mean,
Souness, who used to play for him.
Richarlison was, I think, you know, well entitled to go down at that point, but you're right, it is a bit of a track record of maybe being a little bit more theatrical than he should be. And then it was just a game packed full of incidents, wasn't it? And, you know, there was Mane, I think, should have been sent off when he wasn't. I just think the refereeing in general in the Premier League has not been that great for a while now. And it causes more debate. And then, you know, you've got commentators piling on, that adds fuel to the fire. And I just think when your team's not doing well, you're angry and you're looking for excuses. And
I think that's it.
I think commentary just kind of rubs people up the wrong way, doesn't it? It's not directly offensive and impacting what's happening on the pitch. It's that extra little bit of needle that you just don't want to hear.
But it's part of it.
It causes people to kick off.
I like it. And if you want to check out the full review of that game, as Niall says, loads going on in Liverpool versus Everton. You can check out Fergal and the boys talking about it on yesterday's podcast. Go and check it out. But next, we're going to talk about tonight's Premier League action. It's Crystal Palace versus Leeds. Arguably a much more important match for Leeds than Palace, but we'll talk about it next on Football Social Daily.
Football Social Daily. Subscribe to the podcast now so you never miss an episode. Football Social Daily. Find more great sport at sport-social.co.uk.
Welcome back to Football Social Daily. Let's talk about the Premier League tonight. It is Crystal Palace versus Leeds, and suddenly, after Burnley picked up 3 points at the weekend, it's looking dicey again for Leeds United after we did think they were clear for a little bit.
I thought you were going to say it's looking dicey, but I thought that was...
that would have been good. I wish I had said it's looking dicey. So, in terms of this game for Leeds United, Niall, it's suddenly become really important, hasn't it? Because they need to start picking up points again.
Well, do you know what the strange thing is? I've been looking at Leeds sort of from afar in recent weeks and thinking, oh, they're all right. They seem to be out of it just between Everton and Burnley. Yeah. You know, I think they've won 3 of their last 5 games. They've lost one other, and drawn one other, which is, incidentally, the exact same record as Burnley in the last 5 games, albeit in a different order. So I guess we need to give credit to Burnley. We spoke to Trevor Stephen, a former Burnley player, on the dugout this week. We recorded that just before kickoff between Burnley and Southampton on Thursday, and Trevor was understandably sort of despairing a little bit about what the future might hold for his old team. They've gone and beaten Southampton, and they've gone and won again at the weekend. So actually they've got 6 points in that sort of 4 day spell, and it's really put them in a much better position. And with Everton losing against Liverpool, the bottom of the table is looking really, really interesting. And Leeds, as you say, they're not out of the woods yet. They're 2 points clear of Burnley and have a game in hand. But they need to win because their goal difference is worse. They're minus 30, so that's 14 worse off than Burnley. They're 9 goals worse off than Everton. So if it does get down to it, and dicey, like you say, they're disadvantaged. Hmm. So I think Jesse Marsh has actually done a very good job since he took over from Marcelo Bielsa. But they do need to win. And you're right, it is a more important game for Leeds United than it is for Crystal Palace. If they win, they'll go within a point of Palace in 14th. But I guess that shows the pressures of the Premier League, you know, to win 3 out of your last 5 games. You'd think a month ago, 2 months ago, that would have been enough to keep you up. And now it looks like it might not be. So that is why the Premier League is so ruthless and so brutal. So, yeah, they do need to get a result tonight against Crystal Palace. And even though they're down in 14th, I don't think Palace are the easiest team to just rock up and beat.
No.
So it's going to be an interesting game this tonight. I actually do quite like Jesse Marsh. I was fortunate enough to watch his Salzburg side a couple of times last season and was really impressed with them, albeit in a much weaker league, with all due respect to the Austrian division. But I think he could be a really good appointment for Leeds moving forward, but he just has to keep them up. And it's as simple as that. That's his first task.
How do you look at the sacking of Marcelo Bielsa now, Marley? Now, Marsh has been in place for a little while. As Niall says, Leeds' record's not bad over the last 4 or 5 games. Over the last 5 games, just lost one, drawn one, won all the others. But they have slipped down the table, which I guess is more to do with the teams around them picking up the games they had in hand and doing well in those results rather than Leeds actually slipping up. But do you think we're going to look back at the decision to sack Bielsa as the right call?
Well, proof's in the pudding, really. If he keeps him up, that's all he wanted to do. So probably does have to go down as the right call. I still don't like it. Like I still love what Bielsa does with his teams and how he operates and things like that, and how he picks his teams and doesn't just go and chase money all the way and all the rest of it. And no one will ever do what Bielsa's done for Leeds more than him. Like he got them from nowhere near promotion to in the Premier League. And you know, I think they finished 9th last season as well. So that was huge. And Marsh just needs to harness that and build on it. And I think he has done that so far. He's ground out a few scrappy wins. I don't think they've looked brilliant in any of those games, to be fair. I think they've struggled. I remember the Norwich game where they got the last minute, like last second winner from, I think it was Gelhardt, the young lad. And they've got... like they've got stuff to build on. They just need to add a bit of depth in the summer, survive this season, add a bit of depth and add a little bit more quality and hopefully for them not lose Calvin Phillips. And then they can go from a sort of blank slate next season. But as long as they stay out of this Burnley-Everton scrap, they should be all right. And that's what it comes down to. You know, they've played the same amount of games as Everton and they've got four more points on the board. So If you look at it like that, forget Burnley for now, because they're not the third worst team as the table stands. So just keep looking what Everton are doing and look at their running, and then you look at what Leeds have got, and it's nowhere near as tough. So yeah, Jesse Marsh can be fairly happy because his remit was simply to keep Leeds in the league, because that's what Leeds were fearing. And as things stand, they're doing all right. So Palace tonight are not, you say they're not the hardest. They're not the easiest team to beat, but they're nowhere near the hardest either. So it's a game where you can't go into Crystal Palace and go, we'd be lucky to get something there. You've got to say, you know what, we're not going to play many teams worse than Palace this for the rest of this season. So let's sling everything at them. And if we get 3 points, it's probably enough to keep them up then, because Everton aren't getting 7 points in the next 5 games or so. I just can't see it.
Everton have got Chelsea this week as well.
They've got a really tough run of games at Everton. I've got really worried about Everton
in a couple of weeks as well, which is pretty much where their season comes down to, because obviously if they lose out, they're down. And
how are they so bad?
Like
I'm just thinking of the squad they've got and
so
the team they put out yesterday.
£30 million on Iwobi. It's like, that's how you become bad.
Iwobi's not relegation. I mean, he's not the greatest player. I mean, we know that it's probably far too much money to pay for him, but he'd get into Norwich, Watford and Burnley's team.
It's interesting.
And he'd get into Leeds' team, but...
the know. Amount of times we've looked at teams and gone, they are greater than the sum of their parts. And Leeds are the perfect example of this. Yeah. You go, the players aren't great, but as a unit, they're brilliant. Everton are the diametric opposite of that. They're so much worse than they should be with the personnel they have available.
I think Richarlison starts for Brazil.
Yeah. Richarlison, Calvert-Lewin. I mean, they've got a...
Pickford's England's number one goalkeeper.
The back four is arguably the issue with Everton, isn't it?
Yeah, so. I mean, yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, look at the goals they've conceded this season. They keep losing games. So, you know, you have to say defensively. But they've got Alan, who's a good player. Mm. Decore, obviously, was at Watford. So you can understand why, you know, some people might say that, okay, he's kind of used to that fighting at the bottom of the table sort of thing. But I just think in general, they've got decent players. Mm. Why are they third bottom in the Premier League? That will be... If they go down, if they drop, I think there will be a documentary about it in 5 years' time.
Yeah.
The time Everton got relegated.
I think it's just one of them where, like, I think when Benitez come in, I think they all thought they were better than what Benitez was. Benitez is obviously, like, you know, defence first, and then we'll go from there.
Mm.
And they've all thought, well, we're better than that, that's fine. And then I think they've all, there's just an attitude thing, you know. A team gets you way higher up the league than a bunch of individuals does. It happens all the time.
Yeah.
Look at Man United. Like, they've got, you know, how much they spent £1 billion or something and since Fergie left, and all they've been for 10 years is just a bunch of individuals who are somewhat talented but don't even like each other, if you believe all these rumours that are coming out that there's no unity in the squad. That's why they're sixth. Mm-hmm. And then you look at Everton and you think, why is the squad that good, 18th? And then you look at Burnley, who are improving week by week because they're all together and they all want to fight and stay out of it. And that's what Burnley do every season. You know, Southampton as well. Like, Southampton are 13th. They're by no means the best side in the world, but they at least fight for each other. And if you don't turn up and show them the respect, they'll beat you. Mm. Simple as that. That's why they're 13th in the table and they've never been in any trouble this season. Then you look at Everton, you know, half of them look like they don't know each other's names. Frank Lampard doesn't really know how to organise a defence, hasn't got any experience of fighting this. Mm. So if they do go, it's just, I think someone said, it might have been on Sky Sports or something, but I didn't watch it over the weekend, and it said, it's a blueprint in how not to spend money. And that is Everton in an absolute nutshell.
Do you know what? I think bringing it back to tonight's game, something that Jesse Marsh said that was quite interesting, and no doubt he'll be watching the matches as well, involving Everton and Burnley and the like. But he said about 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, that these players are overworked, they're overtrained. And everyone was always firing shots at Marcelo Bielsa. It's like, well, he's not firing shots at Bielsa, he's just saying this is what he's noticed as he's, you know, since he's come in.
Mm.
Whether that's changed at Leeds or not, whether he's lightened the workload and the results have come off the back of that is a really interesting question. Because we always said that Bielsa, what he does and what he gets his teams to do is really admirable, but is that sustainable in a sort of a 38 game Premier League season against some of the best sides to play club football in the last 20 years? So particularly, I just wonder whether that's made a difference.
Particularly when you've had injuries and your squad gets smaller anyway, so you've got less of a pool to pick from, so the workload for those players that are left is going to increase. So maybe that's where the season came unstuck for Leeds a little bit. As for Crystal Palace, let's look at the other side of this briefly, because there's not a lot to say about Crystal Palace at the moment. They're kind of pretty much safe. It's very difficult to see them dragged into anything. They're 14th at the moment. They've had some brilliant results this season. They've been unimpressive on other seasons. They've definitely built on what they had under Roy Hodgson. They're a more interesting team to watch now. But also at the same time, they're really unpredictable. They beat Arsenal 3-0 one week a couple of weeks back. They lost to Leicester 2-1 the next in a pretty disappointing performance. There doesn't seem to be any real pattern either, between what makes them play well or badly. What causes the swing?
I tell you what, there is a pattern of, and I still need to find out what this statistic actually is, but the amount of late goals they've conceded this season,
this
I reckon they could be knocking around close to the top 10 if they hadn't dropped so many points. Leicester City are another team that have dropped a stupid amount of points from winning positions this season.
There was a point, wasn't there, when Arsenal got them earlier in the season and it was 2-2 at the Emirates. And that was like the third game in a row they'd conceded a 90th minute like point dropper, like loss or something like that.
They definitely did to Brighton in one of the games between them, obviously two rivals. Yeah. They might have even done twice against Brighton. I'm not sure. So we'll look into that at some point. But I'm not sure whether that's a reason as to why that they're so inconsistent, Jim. But I mean, it's certainly a factor in how they've played at times.
Here's a basic stat for you. Crystal Palace have won as many games this season as Everton.
8 games.
They've drawn loads, haven't they?
Yeah. But going back to what I said before, Palace are a side, a team, they fight for each other and they get draws when they're meant to, and they can see out draws when it looks like they're going to, you know, if they run out of steam, they can see out a draw. Everton can't. And, you know, Everton have drawn 5 games and Palace have drawn 13. And it's those extra 8 points that has had them, that's got them the difference between 14th and a plus 2 goal difference versus Everton on 18th and a minus 21 goal difference.
For me, I think Palace's season ended when they lost to Chelsea in the FA Cup semi-final. I think that was their kind of crowning moment, wasn't it? A chance for them to get back to Wembley. They obviously got there in 2016, lost to United in the cup final.
Yeah.
They've never won a major trophy in 116 years of existence or whatever it is. So
Palace always seem to me like the first team on the beach every season, because they sort of float around that mid-table and don't really threaten the top 10 and sort of finish 13th, 14th. Like, I remember it last season under Hodgson, like, they were safe and they had nothing to play for the final 6 games.
Mm.
And it was like, don't wanna watch Palace this week, because they've got nothing to play for. And they're just kind of on the beach and ready for next season and ready to go again. But they are more exciting this season. I'd rather watch them this season than any other season, to be fair. Vieira's doing a good job. But, yeah, it's still come round to that full circle of where they're sort of in that purgatory of mid-table.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I mean, they could still finish top 10, to be fair. But I can't really see it with the inconsistency.
It's a good point that Marley makes, though, Jim, because I'm looking at the table that he's got it up on his computer screen here. And I'm looking at all of the teams from bottom to top. So Norwich, they won the championship last season. Watford got promotion. So you're talking about a side who have had sort of relative glory in recent seasons. Everton, not so much. Burnley, the same. I think their fans are quite happy just to kind of stay around and be above Blackburn in the Football League. I think that's probably their main objective. Villa and Leeds have only sort of in recent last 3 or 4 years come up. But teams like Palace and Southampton, it's like, what is the aspiration season to season?
Maintaining Premier League status.
You think so?
100% at the moment. And I think eventually you have to get into a position where you become, as a football club, an attractive asset that then gets sold and you go on to be a Wolverhampton Wanderers.
Yeah.
But at the moment, with the owners they've got, the aspiration is Premier League safety.
Because you look at Wolves, right? European football. What is it? 2 out of the last 3 seasons or something?
Leicester have won 7-3 times in a row, didn't they?
Yeah, Leicester have won the FA Cup. They're also still in Europe at the moment. West Ham are enjoying a spell at the moment where they're in European football. Even Brentford, it's their first season, and Brighton are looking at finishing in the top 10 for the first time ever. Newcastle have had years of really not doing much, and now they're looking like a club on the up. So with Palace, they've got that vibe of Vieira coming in, and I think the fans are much more excited to turn up to Selhurst every week. But how long does that feel-good factor roll on for? Like, when we start next season, what is it? Is it a top 10 finish? Is that the aim? I guess it has to be for a club like Palace, doesn't it?
I don't know. I don't know whether the club has that level of aspiration, to be honest with you.
I tell you what, let's try and get a Palace fan on in the next couple of weeks and see what they say, because they're the best people to answer that question.
If you are a Palace fan, at the Sports Social, we'll get you on the podcast. You can tell us all about your football club and whether you feel your desires, your aspirations are being fulfilled. But for the moment, Leeds United, it's probably arguably a more important game for them in tonight's final game of the Premier League weekend. Right, last bit of Football Social Daily coming up. We're going to talk about that announcement that the government's going to introduce an independent football regulator after a review of fans came up with 10 recommendations, one of which is this self-governing body to kind of look at football and help it make its decisions. We'll talk about it next on Football Social Daily.
Football's Social Daily. Find more great sport at sport-social.co.uk. Football's Social Daily. Subscribe to the podcast now so you never miss an episode.
Welcome back to Football's Social Daily. We should congratulate ourselves, really, because we talked about Crystal Palace for about 12-13 minutes and didn't once mention the future of Wilfried Zaha. And I think that's the first time that has ever happened.
Because no one cares. Everyone's seen it before. Yeah. Oh, could I have a transfer request? No one wants you. Simple as that.
We're going to talk about the future of football from a governance point of view now, because the government is set to introduce an independent football regulator. There's been a review of fans and they've a review of football by a fan body, which has come up with 10 recommendations to improve the game. And one of those is an independent football regulator, which will look at various issues within the game, including the potential ownership of football clubs and who can and can't own a football club. It's a big step, this, Niall. And is it about time that the government stepped in and stopped football just governing itself? Because, or is it kind of a step too far for the government? Because ultimately, football are businesses. So shouldn't they be allowed to just get on with it?
I wouldn't trust the government to step in and save anything.
I was going to say.
So I agree that
there
should be...
Well, it's an independent body. It's just been sanctioned by the government.
The government are looking to legislate it. Yeah, I understand that. And Tracy Crouch has been sort of a leading vocal figure on this. And she's sort of heralded this as a big step in the right direction. And I've been calling for this for ages. And anyone who's listened to this podcast over the last 3 years and heard me bang on about what happened to Bury and Bolton and Blackpool and Portsmouth and, you know, even Leeds United to an extent, all of these clubs that have been sort of hung out to dry, I welcome this. I think it's essential. I think we need an independent regulator. No shock that the Premier League are against this decision.
Independent and government, can they go in this?
No, this, yeah.
Like, is an independent is independent and government is different, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
I don't trust...
So
I don't,
this doesn't... It doesn't make any sense.
It's kind of like an Ofgem situation. So yeah. Ofgem is rubber stamped by the government to look after energy prices, but ultimately they're independent.
What the ones that are through the roof now and make me not want to leave, put the heating on in case them. Of... Yeah,
I mean, I get what you're saying, Marley. If it was a direct government intervention in football, I don't think that's acceptable. And I don't think that would be welcomed. But
that honestly makes me cringe.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't think of much worse than that.
Put it this way, the bloody, what's she called? The culture of Nadine Dorries, the culture thing.
Horrific woman. Yeah.
She called them tennis pitches at the weekend.
Yeah.
She also talked about
downstream
uploading
movies and build more tennis pitches. And then you go on a Monday, do you want these idiots to be part of an independent regulator? No, not at all.
Invest in some cricket rackets.
Oh, yeah. Go and play polo in
golf
your little,
bats.
You know, everything, you know, go and play in your own little gardens, which we've probably paid for with our tax money. So,
I agree. We don't.
Stay the hell away from the game, please.
Yeah, I don't want the government involved as an independent regulator, but if, because they won't be independent, simple as that. But if the regulator we're talking of is independent, is a body, I think there is
room for it, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. But I do think there are questions to be asked about who sits on that independent body.
Yeah.
Who gets that job? Because it's all well and good creating this new construct, but whoever's inside that is going to be culpable to blame and significant change themselves.
FIFA and UEFA are governing bodies, and they've had, you know, trials and all sorts of stuff thrown at them for years of bribery and corruption and World Cups going to random countries and all the rest of it. And Europa League finals going to Arsenal of Azerbaijan in the middle of May. You know what I mean? It's there's all like, so who's got the clean record to go, yeah, I'll do it. And then everyone goes, well, why you? And then something will come out about them. It's a really hard thing to do.
Yeah.
You can't, it's the hardest thing in the world to introduce something at the top, which is going to overcut everyone and say, we're going to do this right.
You need someone from the FSA, the Football Supporters Association. I think you need someone or even more than one person to sit on a board of this independent body. I think you need someone to come in with understanding of commercialization and marketing, because that's a huge part of the modern game. I think you need someone to come in who is an accountant or with a grip of finance, because they'll have an understanding of whether a new owner that is prospectively buying a football club is fit for the job. You probably need someone with criminal understanding. So I'm not saying someone from the police or someone like that, but if you look at the people that are buying these clubs, the reason that there's been a lot of angst about Newcastle's takeover is because of the Saudi's human rights records. And there's a lot of people that say, well, that should have been looked into. And so maybe you need someone there to do that, to tick that box and please those sorts of people. So I welcome the idea. I think it's much needed, because we can't just have people buying football clubs with no checks. I mean, I can only speak for my team because I lived it. But we had people buying Portsmouth. There was one chap who bought Portsmouth. Nobody knew if he even existed. He'd never been seen in the UK. There was another who bought Portsmouth who had embezzled money from his wife. So no one had checked where the money had come from. They just saw that he had this money. It's like when you go, I mean, not to boil this down too much, but when you go and buy a house, you'll speak to a conveyancer, and that conveyancer will then do checks. And say you use money to buy your house, they need to check where that money has come from, and that you haven't stolen it.
You've got to declare whether it's a gift or it's income or whatever.
Exactly.
You've got to jump through a lot of hoops.
You have to jump through a lot of hoops. at the moment, it feels like there's not enough hoops being jumped through sort of give owners the green light to take over clubs. And I think that's the problem. We're just allowing anyone to take over. And like what I said before about my team, when we were in administration, the Premier League were embarrassed that their mighty construct, the biggest league in the world, had a club that had plunged into administration. And they just wanted to sanction anyone, just get anyone through, get a new owner through instantly. So it's less embarrassing for them. And they didn't care about the knock-on effects of that. And it caused us to spiral out of control. So the less that happens, the better. I welcome the decision of an independent regulator, but I do think it's a really tough thing to get right for all of the reasons we've just mentioned.
It's not just about the ownership of football clubs. There's various issues they're going to be looking at. And it's also clear to say, my understanding is they don't make the rules, this independent body. They will assess whether the decisions that are being made by the Premier League, who ultimately are concerned about money, that's what they're there for, they're a business, whether the decisions they're making are right for football clubs, which are being realised as an asset beyond being just independent businesses. They're being realised as kind of community assets, and they have a place in people's kind of lives and hearts, which we saw with the likes of Bury when they went bust and the effect that had on the community around it. And it's also about the issues, things like the European Super League and the advent of that and the aggression that that shows towards the Premier League. But I think probably one of the bigger issues, or the biggest issue, is that fit and proper owners test, Marley. And there's a decision to be made as to what that criteria is, because as Niall says, there is a question as to whether anyone can come in and buy a football club and run it not into the ground to maintain it as a football club. It doesn't go bust. They protect it as an asset. But the other side of that is what you're facing with Newcastle at the moment, where there was questions over the morality of the people buying the football club. So where do you draw the line? What should the criteria be around the fit and proper owners test? Is it purely about the financials of keeping a football club running? Yeah. Or should we be questioning someone who comes from Saudi Arabian royalty, or I don't know, if the
shady background,
if in 5 years' time, when the issues that are currently ongoing in Ukraine fade into the background and a Russian oligarch wants to come in and buy a football club, do we then let them, in the full knowledge that we now know that the Russian oligarchs who have this extreme wealth, it's ultimately stolen money. There's more of a light on that than previously there was 6 months ago. So what kind of criteria, what benchmarks do we hold for owners?
Well, that's the hardest question I'm ever going to be asked on a Monday morning. Jesus,
if you could wrap it up in 3 minutes.
Jesus Christ. Well, surprisingly enough, I don't know.
Would you rather there had been criteria in place to prevent the Saudi ownership taking over Newcastle?
What do you mean? Like,
if there'd been kind of like...
The only reason that the Saudis wouldn't have been allowed to take over Newcastle is because of the human rights record.
Yeah, correct.
And also the other question marks over ownership are, should a football club be allowed to be owned by, in inverted commas and for want of a better term, a state?
Yeah.
Manchester City are technically owned by a state. Saudi Arabia PSG technically own Newcastle. You know, so there's a question to have. You know, if the US government went and bought West Ham, people would be like, well, this is a bit weird. But for some reason, it's more accepted, whether that's because of the time of the takeover of Manchester City. The Russian oligarch, Roman Abramovich, who did own Chelsea until, of course, recent times. You know, the oligarchs in Russia are effectively the highest wealth you can get, which has almost been gifted to them by the Russian government. So it's questions like that that I think will be answered.
Yeah.
But then you pull up the drawbridge, don't you?
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, whatever comes in, it's too late. Like, ideally, ideal football-wise, like, every club would be owned by a local businessman or a consortium or something. But what we would see is, you know, players getting a maximum of 10 grand a week.
Yeah.
And the Premier League just wouldn't be what it is now. It wouldn't be as big an asset as it is to the country. And
you'll see Derby, who are owned by Mel Morris, so I'm pretty sure is a Derby fan. He's, you know, spent too
just
much money
enough.
Run the club into the ground.
Yeah.
You know, so that's kind of like the other side of it.
Newcastle were owned by John Hall for years, and then Freddie Shepherds and stuff like that. And that was the 90s when, you know, a few hundred grand a year could run a football club. It's just not like that. It's just not that anymore. No one's rich enough to own a football club unless you're, you know, like stupidly, like stinkily rich. Mm-hmm. Like, and those people, the rich people who are,
you know, rich enough to play this game now own weird, you know, countries, or they're part of, you know, huge pots of money from very, you know, questionable backgrounds and things like that. You can't get, you know, a local steel business and buying Sheffield United. Like, you know, Sheffield's, you know, the steel city and stuff, and it's been ran and stuff on the steel industry for you know, 150 years. And they're now owned by a Saudi businessman for 115 million quid.
Yeah.
And it's like...
And the steelworks are owned by an Indian company.
Yeah. And it's just the fact that, like, Britain isn't what it once was. It just, we're not as strong as we were back in, you know, the 1950s when we could sort of self-sustain a bit more. It's just the whole world has changed. Football's changed with it. And you've got to decide, as a fan, whether you like it with all its you know, ugly warts and shady backgrounds, or whether you're the little Mr. Moral on his high horse saying, well, they shouldn't run a club because, you know, they've done this in the past, or they're a country and this country has done that, but are they directly involved? And, you know, they killed a journalist, but who was it who chopped him up into pieces and, you know, chucked him in the sea or whatever it is? It's all horrible backgrounds. And but as we mentioned before, we've missed it. We've missed this by 28 years, 30 years, because it should have came in 92 when the Premier League was formed.
Yeah. How do you create a level playing field from the position we're in now?
You just can't.
I want these three things from an independent body. There's a lot longer of a list, but these are three things I'll pick out. A more thorough and rigorous fit and proper person's test. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to emphasise the two words fit and proper. To be fit enough to run a club, you need to have the financial backing to be able to keep it sustainable. Now, what classes are sustainable is another question. And the word proper, again, is open for interpretation as to whether, you know, if you have questionable background or a questionable past, whether you're acceptable enough to move a football club forward and control what is effectively a community asset. You'd be the steward of that. So that would be one thing, a much more robust fit and proper person's test. Second thing, I want a wages to turnover ratio. So I'd want it so that you can only spend the maximum of, say, let's say 70% of your income on player wages and staff wages.
Makes sense.
Okay, so you can't go and overinflate and spend 110% of your income on player wages and then you're losing money spending it.
Which is the current rule. It's now 70%. That's the kind of benchmark that will come in 3 years, I think it is.
In 3 years, can we change that? Can we tighten that up and look at that? So that's one other thing I want. Third thing, I want fan representation. And that doesn't mean putting a fan on the board, because as I've said before, that one fan can easily be sweetened up and be starry-eyed about the fact that they get free tickets and get to sit in the director's box every week.
They'd be the easiest people to bribe in the world.
Exactly. So more like a fan advisory board. So fan representation may be a group made up of 15, 20 fans who will sit and they will meet with the club once a month, once every 3 months, air their frustrations, and they are considered sort of a shareholder. So they, as a collective, are considered one of the directors. So when a decision gets made in the boardroom, we're going to appoint this manager, or we're going to sign this player, maybe not signing players, but or we're going to change the club crest, we're going to change the kit, make it this colour. That fan group then has a vote in the boardroom as a collective. So that's what I want to see. And I don't think that they're too unreasonable of a requests to make.
No.
And I think it will make football generally a better thing. But, you know, power is something that people love to keep hold of and, you know, really tightly grip onto. And it's much easier to give someone power than to take it away. So, I mean, it's a promising start, but whether we'll see tangible change, I mean, we'll sit here in 2 years and find out, I'm sure.
There you go. Get Niall on the governing body. Get him heading it up. Watch him slowly be corrupted by the money and the power that provides. That is it for today's Football Social Daily. Thank you very much for listening. Don't forget, if you are a Crystal Palace fan, get in touch. We'd love to get you on the podcast to talk about your aspirations as a football club. At The Sport Social on Twitter, you can get in touch there. Or there's plenty of ways to get in touch on the website as well, sport-social.co.uk. Have a great Monday. We'll see you tomorrow.
Football Social Daily. Subscribe to the podcast now so you never miss an episode.